It's officially 2026, and my New Year's resolution is to prioritize high-quality pieces in my wardrobe. Thanks to Quince, I can already check that off my list. I'm already planning outfits around my new cotton Oxford shirt. It's such a classic, timeless piece that I know I'll be rewearing all year. Need more than just a wardrobe update? Quince has tons of options for the home as well. Maya has had the same dinnerware since college and has finally decided it's time for a refresh, starting with a gorgeous set of ceramic cake plates. Refresh your wardrobe with Quince. Don't wait. Go to quince.com/rehash for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/rehash to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/rehash.
Yesterday, I had kind of an insane saga upon arriving in Paris.
Talk about it, babe.
And I told Airbnb if they didn't work with me that I would bring it up on my podcast that has listeners. And then they switched me over to a new customer service correspondent who was like, I'm your new correspondent and I'm finishing work for the day. Talk to you later. That's literally what they sent me. And so Airbnb, I'm about to end you.
As if their bad press with, like, you know, destroying cities single-handedly hasn't fucked them up enough. We're about to put the nail in the coffin.
Oh, yeah. Me, a very powerful public woman with a platform, is going to ring you out.
Hell yeah, mama.
No, in August, myself and our dear beloved friend Mojan, we booked an Airbnb for our trip to Paris. And we were, like, very quickly accepted, but we never got a message from the host, which maybe, like, we should have flagged, but we didn't think about it. Then, like, leading up to the trip, the day before I was supposed to arrive in Paris, which was the day before Mojan, I went to message the host, and she never answered. And I was like, that's weird. Okay, but her profile had a lot of, like, reviews. It was clearly, like, not a scam or anything. And I was just like, what else am I going to do? I have this flight. This is where I'm supposed to go. I'm going to continue on. Kept trying to get in touch with her that day. I had to wake up at like 3:45 to get to the airport to fly to Paris. So by the time I got in, I was exhausted. I lug my suitcase through the Paris metro, up the crazy Paris metro stairs, up some more fucking stairs. Thought I was going to burst a lung or something.
Saw Timothy Chalamet on the walk up with your suitcase.
I'm like 99% sure, yes, that I saw Timothy Chalamet, although like a third of the men here do slightly resemble Timothy Chalamet.
It could have just been a Parisian twink, easily.
But I swear to God, he looked at me like he'd been caught, like someone had recognized him. But then maybe
I believe you. This is how I feel about helping Fran Lebowitz find the checkout aisle at Whole Foods. I was like, would Fran Lebowitz shop here? I don't know, but I'm going to keep this in my head canon.
Well, I did message Dumois on Instagram, and I was like, is Timmy in Paris? And then when I messaged them that, I realized that like 4 years ago, I had sent them a DM about about this time I went to LA, and the waitress told us about how Taylor Swift and Harry Styles is both like had this weird encounter after they broke up in the restaurant that she worked in. And I guess for some reason in the pandemic, I was brought to a point where I was like, I should tell Dumois this story.
That's a really third hand blind item. But I love
yeah,
it.
and Dumois did nothing with it, and so.
My friend's nephew told my friend that his girlfriend's cousin saw Timothy Chalamet in Paris.
That's basically all Dumois is. So anyways, going back to it, I show up at this place. I still haven't heard from the woman, but I have the address. And then some man like lets me in and tells me what apartment is hers. So I was like, okay, I go up to her apartment, ring the doorbell. No one's in there. So I hear Australian like podcast playing from across the hall, and I was like, okay, so an English-speaking woman in her 20s lives in this apartment. Thank God. So I knock on her door, and this angel, her name is Clear, she's from Australia, yeah, which is amazing.
It's actually Clear,
yeah. And I didn't it didn't hit me in the moment, although it would have been funny if I made a comment. So she was such an angel, and she got in touch with the host for me, and the host was like, I didn't mean to accept that. Mind you, we booked this in August.
That's insane. Just like, were they apologetic at all?
Yeah, she was trying to get in touch with Airbnb about it. I'm still confused about what happened, but here I am in Paris with nowhere to stay. So I booked a hostel for the night, and Mojan, who was the one who booked the original Airbnb, spent like her morning trying to correspond with Airbnb to get us a new place, which they finally did. But they're being really stingy about discounts, even though they like kind of fucked us over. And anyways, I had to pay like 80 euro for a hostel for the night. And so I am trying to get my own compensation for that. So I'm making good on my threat Airbnb.
Sometimes it really takes going full Karen to get what you want. Like, I won't get into it. I can't even, the trauma of it. But I truly had the most insane ordeal with Verizon trying to get my Wi-Fi set up here. I was on the phone with them for a total of 12 hours, like combined total of 12 hours one day. And by the end, I was crying into the phone, talking to them like they were breaking up with me. Like, I was like, they were like, we're gonna call you back. I was like, you never call back. You say to call back and you never call me back. Like, I cannot trust you anymore. The trust is broken. And like, eventually they basically canceled. They kept getting orders for someone to come in and set up my Wi-Fi and then canceling it without asking me and then setting up a new order, fucking that up. They fucked up every single step of the process. I was crying, and it eventually took me straight up screaming. And like, I know customer service people take abuse, I get it, but honestly, sometimes when the company is so fucked but being put through so many phone trees, it is impossible to be chill. And also, like, yeah, if you're getting fucked over financially by a company, you need to kind of get your money. And the only way to get your money is to scream on the phone. And so, well,
yeah,
I let someone have it. I really was pissed. And they were really nice about it. And then I was like, thank you so much for understanding.
Well, just also, it's like, these companies don't ever put you on the phone with someone who can really make things happen. So you always end up talking to someone who's reading off of like a script, essentially, who's not making like a decent wage, I can only imagine. And they're the ones that have to deal with people who are upset or in distress or like trying to figure something out. And it's like impossible to talk to someone who can actually like make a real decision or make something happen for you. So it's just like the most frustrating situation.
A lot of these people are also working from home now, so there's like really bad intra-department communication. Like I'd be talking to two people from one department and they'd both be saying different things to me. It was truly the definition of Kafkaesque. I was like, this is surreal. But no, I get you, girl, and I hope you get the 80 euros back, because that's expensive as fuck. The Canadian dollar is not in a place right now for you to be dropping 80 euros on something.
Oh my God. The Canadian dollar is... she's not helping me right now. It's really bleak.
She gives me the heebie-jeebies.
Yeah.
Anyways.
I'm Hannah.
And I'm Maya.
And this is Rehash, a podcast about the internet phenomena that strike a nerve in our culture only to be quickly forgotten, but we think are due for a revisiting. This season is about internet subcultures, the stories of how they arrived, thrived, and sometimes died. If you like our show and want to hear more from us, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/rehashpodcast, where we have monthly bonus episodes, weekly mini episodes, and early access to our regular programming. Yummy. If you don't want to join the Patreon, feel free to rate and review us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, because that helps a lot. Disney's animated film canon spans almost 90 years, going back to 1937, when Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs became the first full-length feature of the medium. The best of these films have been celebrated for their ability to appeal to children and parents alike by communicating complex emotional themes through beautifully detailed animation. And so, for baby boomers and their millennial offspring, the odds of escaping childhood without at least one piece of Disney media imprinting on you are obviously very slim. what is your relationship with Disney? Like, are there particular films that still hold a place in your heart?
Oh, yeah. Mulan is my favorite Disney film. It's beautiful. That sequence, like that montage where she cuts off her hair and there's that intense like synth music. Oh, it gets me every time. Like, it makes me emotional. I love Mulan. I think it's a masterpiece. I love Sleeping Beauty for its artistic direction. Like, the animation in that movie is some of the most incredible and, like, honestly, kind of underappreciated animation. Like, it's really cool. They were using really advanced technology with that. And then I ended up having to, like, scale it back during the Disney Dark Ages because they didn't have enough money. But that was, like, really Disney, to me, at its peak in terms of animation. God, I'm sounding like such a fucking nerd. And then Lilo and Stitch is also one of my favorites because I think it's, like, one of the few times Disney's been actually realistic and, like, nuanced about a particular culture. And I just think it's just a beautiful film. Like, it's great. I really hate that they're doing a live action adaptation.
Lilo and Stitch is a really good one. I feel like underappreciated. I had Lilo and Stitch toothpaste when I was little, which just meant it was blue. But that was definitely, I think, probably the ones I've seen the most out of the Disney canon. My mom is always like, we had all the Disney princess movies. And I'm like, girl, no, we didn't. We didn't own any of them. I think we had Hercules. So my Disney princess is Meg. And then we had, like, Winnie the Pooh, which is my favorite of the Disney canon. That and Fantasia. I loved Fantasia for some weird reason.
Winnie the Pooh makes me cry. I love Winnie the Pooh.
I love Winnie the Pooh. I was thinking, I was like, I don't get that nostalgic over Disney properties. And then I remembered that Winnie the Pooh was Disney. And then I was like, oh, no. Winnie the Pooh makes me emotional in a weird way.
Oh, it's so cozy.
It's so cozy. It's so cute. Also, you know how everyone's like, oh, the first time I got really upset at a movie as a child was like Bambi or The Lion King or Dumbo or something. For some reason, mine is The Fox and the Hound, which, like, no one has seen or talks about, I feel like.
Disney Dark Ages. But it's, yeah, really sad.
It's so sad that, so The Fox and the Hound, when they grow up, they can't be friends anymore. And it's really sad.
Speaking of anthropomorphic or, like, animal attachments, Disney definitely did some work there.
Yeah. And so through their ability to both, you know, make us shed tears, but also spark wonder, I think many of us form strong emotional attachments to our favorite Disney films, like we were saying, which is, you know, normal with things that you watch as kids. But then there are the small but powerful minority who call themselves Disney adults. While many of our connections to Disney are nostalgic, a Disney adult is based more so in the present, with many of them going to extreme lengths to live out their own Disney fairy tale 365 days of the year. Many of you are likely familiar with Disney adults already, because over the years, they've become one of the internet's favorite punching bags. We're going to be talking about why a little bit later in the episode, but first I wanted to establish, like, what a Disney adult is. So, Maia, I know you're familiar with Disney adults. So, like, what do you... Sorry. I know you're familiar
exactly
with Disney adults,
like, because the furries episode where I was like, you probably clearly, like that.
As you clearly exemplified with your knowledge, you are one. What do you picture when you think of, like, a stereotypical Disney adult?
Okay, I think Disney adults are typically kind of millennial coded. I think typically someone who is a nerd who wears a lot of Disney paraphernalia, like, very much buys into the Disney brand, and, like, do a lot of their stuff online. Like, I think a lot of, like, Disney adults have a pretty big presence online, a lot of which is, like, them crying, seeing their favorite characters. A lot of it is wrapped around, like, going to Disneyland and having an emotional experience there and then, like, documenting that. I also associate it with, like, a very, like, blind love for Disney in a way that's, like, a little bit insane, because Disney is such a fucked conglomerate that treats their workers very poorly, among many other things. So yeah, that's just, like, my general idea of it.
Well, no, and so we'll be talking about some of those points that you brought up later on in the episode. But yeah, I think there are different facets of Disney adulthood, and that perhaps, like, Disney adult has become a catch-all for all sorts of points on the Disney fan spectrum. Like I said up top, you know, a lot of people, particularly millennials, they still feel attached to certain pieces of Disney media, like going into adulthood. And some, you know, may also go and see the newer films as they come out, despite not being, you know, kids anymore. But to me, those people are more just adult Disney fans, not necessarily part of the Disney adult subculture. And so there's a lot of really good Disney media, and I don't think it's necessary to judge people for being fans of children's things, especially when, you know, a lot of that stuff was released when they themselves were kids. But I think that there is a group that has turned that interest into a lifestyle, and that's who I'm going to refer to here when we talk about Disney adults as a subculture. Because I think as we sort of establish the parameters of what an internet subculture is on this podcast, like throughout the season, I do think that while a lot of it is obviously related to how people behave online, I think what really brings something like into subculture territory is also how it influences their life outside of the internet and the role that it plays in that capacity. So with that in mind, like, can you think of some elements that like might make Disney adults a subculture instead of just a fandom?
I think that having like rules for membership other than just liking Disney is definitely the main factor there. Like, I think a fandom is like, yeah, it's people who just enjoy, like, anyone can just be a fan of Disney and be a part of the Disney fandom by virtue of that. But I think people who absorb it into like themselves and how they act on a daily basis definitely changes that. So I think wearing specific clothing that like associates you with Disney, or like having to obtain certain Disney merch or Disney paraphernalia, or like placing like kind of like a commodity fetishist spiritual value around certain Disney products, like I think also plays into that. I just think that the idea of like self-identification kind of changes it, and like the everyday aspect of that.
For the people that I think qualify as being within like the Disney adult subculture, I think they're acknowledging one, like, yeah, their identity as Disney adults, but then they're also really like shaping their lifestyles from, you were saying, like how they dress, how they decorate their homes, how they choose to like spend their money and like save their money, all towards participating in this group that like does require you to like spend a lot of money in order to kind of spiritually remain a part of. So some examples would be like going to the park as often as possible, maybe even getting like a yearly pass, or people who even move to Orlando in order to be close to the park, or people who buy homes in the Golden Oaks housing development that was built within a Disney resort.
Wow.
Obviously, those are worth millions of dollars. Some people hire Disney specializing interior decorators, or just take it upon themselves to decorate their homes so that they resemble the films or the parks. You know, you might have like a different room dedicated to a different property. People Disney bound, which you were saying, like the way you dress, Disney bounding is a way to dress like different Disney characters without wearing like costumes. And then there's the celebrating like life milestones in theme parks. And then if, you know, they have kids, they are making a really conscious effort to incorporate Disney into their lives from a young age so that their memories are also sort of oriented around trips to Disney World. And then just like ultimately spending a lot of money to be a part of it. Yeah, to have all the Disney merchandise, to collect it all.
I'm going to have a kid and we're going to make our own little Disney empire just inside the home.
Your kids, Aurora and Peter Pan. And Goofy.
And there's Goofy.
This episode is brought to you by Mubi, a curated streaming service dedicated to elevating great cinema from around the globe. From iconic directors to emerging auteurs, there's always something new to discover.
With Mubi, each and every film is hand-selected, so you can explore the best of cinema, streaming anytime, anywhere. Now playing in theaters in the US and streaming exclusively on Mubi is Coralie Farjad's shocking body horror film, The Substance. I adored Demi Moore in her performance as Elizabeth Sparkle, a famed fitness instructor who finds herself past her prime by Hollywood standards. When Elizabeth is presented with the opportunity to find youth through the mysterious Substance, she gets more than she bargained for with Sue, played by the magnetic Margaret Qualley. Praised for its gross-out effects and critique of rigid beauty standards, The Substance was the talk of TIFF and even won the Midnight Madness Award. You can try Mubi for free for 30 days at mubi.com/rehash. That's mubi.com/rehash for a whole month of great cinema for free. So Disney has always done a pretty good job at appealing to children and adults and like sort of packaging itself as something the whole family can enjoy. Walt Disney has even said that the aim of his work was to create the feeling of childhood because that's the best part of a man's life. You have expressed earlier your familiarity with the different Disney eras. So could you sort of explain to the uninformed what the Disney Renaissance is?
Okay, just to say, I've obtained all of this through, like, YouTube video essay brain rot. Or brain nourishment, you could even
She's
say.
She's not a Disney nerd. She's a YouTube nerd.
I'm a YouTube nerd. Let's be clear. So the Disney Renaissance, essentially Disney in the, like, 60s, kind of soon after Walt Disney died, a little bit before his death as well, 60s and 70s and 80s kind of fell into disrepair within the organization, had trouble with leadership, had trouble with viewership, weren't bringing in as many box office sales, their animation department kind of crumbled. And so if you look at a lot of the Disney Dark Age films, like the animation is less sophisticated and polished than the earlier Disney films, which is interesting because this is like later on down the line with more advanced technology. And then when the 90s rolled around, well, actually we're in 19, I think it was 89 rolled around, Disney made The Little Mermaid, which they partnered with Howard Ashman, who was this extremely talented kind of like lyricist. I don't know if he was a composer, but to essentially write like all the songs in this movie. And it ended up being a massive hit. And after that, it sparked off like an entire decade of Disney releasing these very like engaging musical fantasy films. So you have like Tarzan and Beauty and the Beast, which won, it was like the first, I think, animated movie to win an Oscar. I think it was nominated for Best Picture or won Best Picture.
It was the first animated film to be nominated for Best Picture.
To be nominated for Best Picture, another Howard Ashman vehicle. Mulan, like, you got all these movies, and it kind of put Disney back on the map financially and bolstered them a whole lot of money. And then they went into their flop sequel era and, like, have had trouble coming out of it ever since.
That was, wow, like a better explainer than I could have ever done. Thank you very much. I love that that was all at the top of your noggin.
I spent a lot of time watching video essays.
And you absorbed it. She's a good student.
Thanks, girl.
One of the kind of key things about those Disney Renaissance films is that while they did, like you were saying, sort of like revamp it and sort of elevate what they were making, they were also designed to appeal to the nostalgia of boomers who were the parents of the millennials who were seeing these films. So while during the sort of darker ages for Disney, there weren't as many princess narratives or like fairy tale narratives or proper musicals, they went back to that for the Renaissance films so that like the adults taking the kids to these movies would also enjoy them and would also see something reminiscent of their childhoods, because boomers would have grown up during like the silver age or the silver era of Disney, which would have had, you know, Cinderella, Sleeping Beauty, Peter Pan, The Jungle Book, like all of these really classic films. And so it was sort of a genius move to try and appeal to both age groups because it created like a shared bonding experience and basically set up Disney to be something that like the millennials themselves would grow up to be nostalgic for the way their parents were. Did your parents ever show you older Disney films? Or yeah, like ones that they might have grown up with?
Yeah, my parents definitely show, like, I mean, both my parents, my mom grew up with Disney.
I realize asking this that your parents specifically might not have had that experience. mine neither.
Dirt poor growing up. But my dad may have come into contact with them, but I think they just had cultural knowledge generally of them. And they did show them to me. Like, I watched a lot of old Disney movies growing up, like all of the old ones, just because they were canon. And also, I think when we were growing up in the 2000s, this was a lot of the time when Disney started to kind of amalgamate all of their iconography and like their characters into these kind of commodified, Disney started to basically commodify their characters, like sell dolls based on the characters, and like they had like the Disney princess kind of universe where they would put all the Disney princesses together and like sell merch like that. So that was kind of around the boom of when Disney was really starting to merchandise, and I think that also made my parents like have a greater awareness of like all of the properties. Like, it was a good way of kind of rejuvenating properties that were from almost a century ago, essentially.
Well, and it's also interesting to think about how outside of Disney, it's hard to get kids to watch old films. And when you think about the fact that Cinderella, for example, came out in the 1950s or Snow White came out in the 30s, most kids in our generation, other than obviously The Wizard of Oz or something like that, but like most kids in our generation wouldn't be watching films from those decades the way that they
consume Disney
films. My ass
was definitely watching Gumby and Betty Boop when I was a kid. But like, I don't know why. I think my dad just bought me box sets of like all these.
You just had an old dad.
But they scared me. And I had a really old dad, so that may have been why.
But it's just the only time like kids are actively and excitedly consuming classic films, like old films, which I just think is interesting. But yeah, so striking that balance between like enticing child and adult audiences was and continues to be a key aspect of Disney's business plan. And of course, the parks, which, you know, featured iconography from all these different eras, had something for everyone to enjoy too. But in the 1990s, Disney also began to market its parks as a place that adults could visit without kids at all. In 1989, Walt Disney World opened Pleasure Island, which encompassed a number of different nightclubs in its shopping center. I don't know why they settled on that name. I think it's so funny. And Pleasure Island closed in 2008, but like there are places to drink throughout the park. Like, if you want to get a buzz on at Disney, that's very easy.
Sounds like a really terrible like 2000s dating show.
Pleasure Island.
Literally Temptation Island.
Yeah, literally.
Although that's a great show.
I mean, no, Pleasure Island sounds dirtier than Temptation Island. It's like more to
the Well, it's more encouraging of sex than Temptation Island is.
And but also I love the idea of people wanting to get like a go night clubbing whilst at a Disney resort, as if there's not enough on their plate. Aren't you exhausted from standing in the sun all day?
And also, just like, imagine. Don't you just want to go to any other nightclub anywhere else?
Well, I imagine like it's because you're already staying at the park for like a week. And you want to go
like
out.
The markup on a vodka soda at a Disney bar would be crazy.
Probably $21 for a single shot of vodka. Yeah, absolutely insane. Then also in 1996, they put out a travel guide for guests planning a trip to the parks without kids. And they started putting ads out to kind of promote it as something you could just go do as adults. And basically, yeah, parenthood was no longer a prerequisite to enjoy some Disney magic. The actual term Disney adult is generally thought to have come about in the early 2010s. Before this, adults were obviously still using the internet to blog and chat about their love for Disney because, as we've established, nerds be on the internet talking about their special interests. But the term Disney adult is thought to have come from the trend of Disney bounding, which I mentioned earlier. So Disney bounding comes from Canadian blogger Leslie Kay, and it's
They're always Canadian.
I know. I'm like, what are you doing being a Disney fan You have to fly to another country to enjoy any of that shit. But
we're just a really online population, apparently. Like, every episode, I'm like, and then a Canadian said this. Like, what?
Then someone dialed into the internet from their igloo.
Nice.
So Disneybound was the name of Leslie Kay's blog. She came up with the idea for the blog whilst on her way to a Disney park, and so she called it Disneybound. She was Disneybound, and this is where she first started posting these like polyvore-esque collages of outfits inspired by Disney characters. So like, you know, if you wanted to dress like Winnie the Pooh, maybe you would have like yellow skinny jeans and then like a little red t-shirt and then like a yellow headband or something.
Okay, Winnie the Pooh invented the baby tee.
Oh my god, so true. We have him to thank for crop tops, for sure.
He also invented men wearing a t-shirt and no pants and going, Mom, I did a poo.
And they're literally doing a poo. The poo. Winnie the Pooh.
Anyways.
And so what Leslie Kay was doing came about because if you were to go to a Disney park as an adult, it's against the rules to actually dress up as a character in their costume. Obviously, people don't want to have the real characters be confused for guests and vice versa.
You don't want like a kid going up to some rando who isn't actually working there and being like, may I give you a hug? You know?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Also, like, you could definitely pretend you're a Disney character and like charge people probably to take photos with you or something. So finding clever ways to dress in like the likeness of characters really took off with the Disney adult community. Disney bounding became the subject of like BuzzFeed style listicles and sort of all that good early 2010s stuff. And so it's around this time that the name Disney Adult was sort of established, and it's also the time that, like, I think they maybe came into public consciousness as a community. Do you have any guesses as to why, like, the early 2010s would be that period?
Social media?
Yeah.
Kind of coming out and making everyone forced to make little personas of themselves on the internet in a mainstream way? I would assume that would, and like just like the communication and like the ability to make like groups on Facebook and that kind of thing, I would assume.
Yeah, me too. I'm thinking something like that. I think also like Tumblr blowing up, but then also like millennials are very much like the demographic associated with Disney adults. And I think the demographic that at least popularized the Disney adult identity. And this is the kind of the time where they were hitting adulthood properly and having, you know, the money and agency to participate in this lifestyle.
Apparently lots of money.
God, I mean, I hope for their sakes that they have lots of money and that it's not.
Well, I think I remember hearing statistics back in the day that millennials were like the most employed generation or something, or they were more entrepreneurial than Gen X or something like that. So it would, I guess, make sense that millennials would have more disposable income. But then famously, there's the housing crisis.
They spend it all on avocado toast, though. They're all broke.
Right. Fuck, I forgot. And that's why the housing bubble, something, something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then the TV show Girls or something.
Something, something.
Millennials.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So as Disney adults make their way into the public consciousness, the public did not respond well to them. Can you imagine?
I could not fathom.
I do think there was probably a period of time during like the heyday again of like BuzzFeed where being a Disney adult was akin to being a Star Wars nerd. It's kind of cringy and maybe a bit annoying, but ultimately harmless. And also I think when millennials were sort of the dominant tastemakers, it was a bit more acceptable to be a Disney adult because they're the ones who again seem to be the most nostalgic towards Disney in general. But in more recent years, since I guess Gen Z took the throne, Disney adults have incited a lot of real outrage online and become the subject of endless think pieces and video essays. Do you want to list off, we've talked about it a bit at the top, but like some more kind of common criticisms of Disney adults.
Cringe, number one. People think they're so annoying and cringe. More valid ones, like, one of the bigger issues is just that, like, as opposed to a subculture like, oh, punk subculture, oh, even with furries, like, the requirement for membership of a Disney adult is, like, to really buy in holistically to Disney as a brand and treat it almost like a religion. And Disney is not a good company. While they have made us some incredible pieces of media, some incredible films, incredible art, all this stuff, they have historically been terrible. Like, contemporarily, Disney has just been, like, destroying their own IP, you know, making these horrible, artless sequels and prequels to all of their movies and, like, live action stuff. They pay their animators garbage. A lot of people who work for Disney, I'm pretty sure, they kind of treat it like campus culture. Like, a lot of people live at the Disney campus or something like that. And
The Disney College program, which is where you make less than a livable wage and have to, I'm pretty sure, like, I think now you don't have to live in their, like, residences, but there was a while where you did, but you also had to pay to live in them and pay for all your expenses and everything while working, like, not enough hours to live off of the
money. For Disney. Yeah, it's, like, kind of, it's extremely exploited labor. Oh my god, there's endless issues, like the union bust, I'm pretty sure. And, like, a lot of what comes with it also is, like, actually not only buying in spiritually to Disney as a brand, but also buying from Disney as a brand, like, buying official Disney merch, you know, making the company a lot of money. So it's not exactly the most accessible or affordable hobby or pastime. And it's all towards this company that, like, yes, makes beautiful children's art, but also is a real life corporation that treats its workers badly. And so it's, like, the blind nostalgia and, like, love for it just seems really misguided and sometimes even kind of tactless. Although, yeah, I don't think that's why people are hating on Disney adults. I think that's why critical thinkers like myself are hating on Disney adults.
Why do you think other people are hating on Disney adults?
Because they're cringe. However, me, okay, a lover of cringe, doesn't mind that at all.
She loves furries after all.
And I do.
But no, these are all great points, and we're going to be going in a bit farther into some of them throughout this episode. So what I wanted to do is I wanted to talk about, like, three main critiques I've noticed about Disney adults, which is the first, that they're big babies. The second is that they're over-consumers. And then the last is, like you're saying, they're worshiping a corporation like a religion. And we're going to use some different viral Disney adult moments to illustrate each of these, ones that really got a lot of outrage when they made the rounds. So let's start. So, like I said, the first kind of critique is that Disney adults are self-infantilized babies. And in 2019, a lot of discourse was sparked around this idea when an alleged Facebook post by someone claiming to be a mother ranting about childless millennials at Disney World went viral on Reddit and Twitter. So I'm going to send you the post and I want you to read it out for everyone.
Whoa, lots of caps here and, like, angry faces. I'm going to try and read the caps.
Channel your drama kid.
As a performance, yes, thank you.
Yeah.
It pisses me off to no end when I see childless couples without at Disney World. Angry face, angry face. Disney World is a family amusement park, yet these immature millennials throw away their money on useless crap. They have no idea the joy and happiness it is to mothers who buy their babies treats and toys. They will never experience the exhaustion that is to chase a three-year-old around and getting stares at assuming I'm a bad mother. This cunt. Oh my god. This cunt in some very slutty shorts was buying a Mickey pretzel and Aiden with an E. Wanted one. But the line was very long, so I said later, and it broke his poor little heart, and he cried. I wanted to take that fucking pretzel from that tramp. Like, thanks, bitch. You made my son cry. Angry face, angry face. Disney World is for children. People without children need to be banned. Mothers with children should be allowed to skip all the line. You have no fucking idea what it is to have to stand in line for 3 hours with a cranky, tired, exhausted toddler. And I can't just tell him that we can't do something because it's his vacation too. I fucking hate childless women. Oh my God. With a burning passion. Angry face, angry face.
You know who wrote that? J.D. Vance.
At first I was like, hey, I'm with her. For a little bit of that. And then she started the cunt, slut, childless woman stuff kind of took me out.
There is like debate over whether or not this is like a real post. As you can see, the name and face are scratched out. And, you know, it was blowing up on Reddit and Twitter. So who the fuck knows where these things come from, but the post itself still caused a lot of debate and started discussion around Disney adults in spaces that some people view as being just for children. So obviously Disney adults were quick to defend their right to go to the parks on the basis that they were designed with both adults and children in mind, and that adults who, you know, will likely form stronger memories from their trips to the parks and appreciate the Imagineers, find attention to detail, will perhaps
That's what they call
get
the
more...
Disney Engineers, guys, just
yes,
so you know.
Imagineers. These adults will perhaps get more enjoyment than child guests. What do you think of this argument?
I think it's fair to argue for your right to go to the park. I think it's another level to say that you actually deserve it more than the kids because you'll remember it better. Like, one, childhood is a very formative experience. I don't remember things I did a week ago, but I do remember many aspects of my childhood extremely vividly. And I think that that's a strange argument to rely upon. I do think they have a right to go to the parks and to not be like bullied on the internet about it, but I also think that children, first and foremost, in a lot of spaces, like, there's already so few spaces for children, and like, this is something we've talked about on the Patreon a lot, but like, there is just like a growing anti-child sentiment on the internet, and like, people arguing that children should be like pushed out of certain spaces that they think are meant for only for adults, like pubs, for example, which I actually disagree with, and I think that children should be socialized into many spaces. Obviously, there are some that children don't belong, but for someone to argue that they have a right more than children to be in a space, it is designed for adults and children, but like very much optimized for children, feels strange. However, I do agree that they have a right to go there. Sure.
Why do you think that these Disney adults feel such entitlement over the parks? Like, why do you think people, even as grown-ups, continue to like want to spend time at this place, which, like you said, is optimized for children?
Well, I think it's like a lot of them have just felt like they've invested so much into this company. They've invested more than others. I think that's a big thing with subcultures, is like, who is more this culture than the other? I think there's a lot of like gatekeeping around that. And I think Disney adult, it's like, children can't go be a Disney adult because they're children and they don't have disposable income. But like, a Disney adult can, you know, many kids' parents aren't going to buy them all the things that require membership to be a Disney adult. But like, Disney adults can because they're adults and they have disposable income. And so I think part of it's that, like, I think that they feel like they've invested. I also think that a lot of these millennials feel like Disney is theirs because they grew up contemporaneously, like, with the media. So it's like, they're like, this is my movie. They feel an attachment to it that maybe younger generations don't. And so going to these places is nostalgic for them because it's like reliving their childhoods. So that would be my other guess.
Reliving their childhoods is sort of a key point. Disney has done a really great job at making their parks a sort of core part of a lot of people's childhoods and childhood memories. And because they're a theme park and because every single detail in the park contributes to the sort of Disney branding, including the way that they make the park smell using these machines that scent the air in specific ways so that you'll like form memory attachments and like want to buy things, which I think is so crazy and creepy and I'm fascinated by.
But, it's like Subway spraying their stores specifically so that you think of Subway when you smell that scent.
Well, yeah, exactly. But Disney is doing it at this place where people do go as kids, are taken by parents or grandparents or like whatever adults in their lives, and coming to associate all of the kind of sensorial details with happy moments in their childhood. And so once you re-enter the park and you smell those things again and you notice those details again, besides just being in a place that is technically designed for children, you're also being brought back to a state of childhood through all of the different like memories that are sparked by being in that space. And I think a lot of people feel like they're able to sort of resort back to this idea of childhood innocence when they go into the parks. Like it kind of transports them.
The tagline for Disneyland is the happiest place on earth. And so I think,
well, yes,
you know, that's what it's meant to be.
Yeah, and they've done a really good job at creating that for some people. But this whole idea of like a place that sort of resorts you back to this almost like childhood state where everything you're kind of taking in transports you, I was really thinking about that a lot. And I'm like wondering, like, do you have anywhere from your childhood? And I'm not necessarily talking about like vacations or kid themed things, but just anywhere where you have those kinds of associations, like your kind of childhood happy places.
My aunt's house.
Aww.
I know this isn't a child specific place, but we used to go to my aunt's house very often because they lived really close to us, and she always makes lamb for some reason. Like she's addicted to making lamb, and her house had a really specific scent. Like I think she cooked with a lot of rosemary, and so there's a really specific scent that I like associate with her that just brings back really intense memories, like sensorial memories for me. I always had a really nice time at her place. I love my aunts and uncle. So yeah, I mean, there's so many smells, and you know, even for the Emos episode, I was listening to, you know, My Chemical Romance and got like a really intense emotional reaction to it. One, because I think the music's great, but also two, because of the memories it evoked. So I don't know, there's a lot, but I would say my aunt's place is like a space that I feel attached to.
Yeah, no, well, I was gonna say, for me, it's like my granny's house, which is no longer like in our family anymore, but in my kind of European travels, I spent about a month in Ireland, and I drove through the town where my mom grew up for the first time in 10 years. And there's this substance called peat that they use to heat the houses in a lot of kind of older houses in Ireland. And it's a smell that I can't really describe for you, but like once I smell it, I know it, and I'm brought back to my childhood. And when my aunt and I were driving through the town, I started like making myself lightheaded with trying to absorb as much of that smell as possible, and sort of just like being back there in general, eating kind of really simple foods and everything was just bringing me to like, I felt so happy and content, but it was just in this way where I felt like I was a kid in the comfort of like my granny's kitchen again. Which I think when I hear about these people having this association with Disney World as that being the site of whatever like childhood memories they're nostalgic about, I feel like this was like something I could understand or like empathize with them on. But I do think that there are obviously big differences between the places we're describing and a Disney theme park.
And also differences in the way that you would go about like attaining that memory, like trying to get that memory.
Yeah.
Like mine kind of happens upon me. Like my aunt will buy West Indian food for all of us, and it just reminds me of my grandma and like tastes like the memory of her, and similar with you. But those are things that just kind of happened. You're not like spending all your money trying to get that. It's something that's in the past. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, exactly. And like those scents, they weren't manufactured to breed nostalgia. They are organic. They just exist in these places. And also, you know, as I'm sure you experience at your aunt's house, it's like even when you do get excited and anticipate like going back to these places, it's not like the places themselves are constantly fostering to your desire for nostalgia. Like, we would go to my granny's house and I would get all excited about it because it was my happy, like, comfort place. But then, like, I'd be just sort of there with my family and it wouldn't be that exciting beyond those initial feelings. And I'm sure you have similar feelings about your aunts. But I think when you're at Disney, it's like they're meeting your need for like this nostalgia, but then they're also constantly keeping you occupied with things to keep you happy, to keep you satisfied, I suppose.
It's very dystopian. Like, I think that there is, of course, an element that's like well-intentioned to Disney. I think Walt Disney was well-intentioned when he like made this park and he did want to see people like, you know, having fun and stuff. But there's also the element that it's like, this is a corporation and they want to make money off of you. They want you to stay at Disney for as long as possible. They're going to charge you up the ass for, like, I don't fucking know, like, a pair of Mickey Mouse ears and send you on your merry way. And so it's like, and at the end of the day, like, they're not your family because my family doesn't charge me to go to their house.
No. And also, like, your family homes leave the family. They're not constant. They change. Who lives there changes. If you go to Disney, you're going to find the same places there and the same characters played by different people for eternity, and it's like stuck in time, but it also like evades time.
Totally.
Sarah Marshall, the genius host of You're Wrong About, wrote a really great piece on Disney World for The Baffler. And at one point in the article, she asks, "You have to buy a day of childhood at Disney World, and this is not remotely right. But on the other hand, where else can you go in America today to buy such a thing?" And I think for a lot of people, you know, who, I don't know, I guess maybe are run down by adult life or feel disenchanted by it, like, there is an appeal to being able to step foot in that kind of Neverland type space.
I think in our desire to, like, hate all millennials, which is something I feel strongly about and, like, really don't like that has happened on the internet, I don't think that we've ever been very empathetic towards them and, like, maybe why millennials feel the need to be nostalgic. Like, it doesn't come from nowhere, you know? And it's a generation that was, like, the first generation to have to come to terms with, like, oh, the climate crisis, the housing crisis, like, having all of these financial concerns, like, having to grow up faster in a way, but not having the tools to do so. And I think that that makes people want to retreat back to a different time and, like, a time before all of that happened. And so I think having a little bit of empathy for people who want that feels necessary here. And I don't think that millennials get that empathy in the way that I think Gen Z has actually gotten a lot of empathy for their struggles. And I just don't love the derision that's been thrown that generation's way a little bit. So, yeah.
Maya is a passionate millennials rights advocate.
I'm just a bit like, I don't know why everyone from all directions is just like hating.
It's, no, they definitely.
I don't remember hating a generation when I was younger. I don't know why everyone hates millennials in such a vehement way.
Hating other generations is supposed to be something you do once you're an old person and you just hate young people. But to be young and hating the slightly older is a little like, you don't know what you're
all
about
going
yet,
through
sweetie.
The same thing. And, like, of course, millennials shouldn't hate on the younger generation, but that feels more normal and, like, doesn't feel as pervasive on the internet as millennial hate, so I don't know, but whatever.
No, I totally get what you're saying. But Marshall, she then goes on to point out how Disney has a reputation of shady labor practices, like we've mentioned earlier, in its parks, and how said parks are disgustingly expensive and often require you to spend more than just that initial entrance fee to enjoy your visit. And she has this quote that I really liked to end off her article, where she says, "This is the story Americans have been sold, the one that pardons the powerful and makes us pay for our own numbness. We submit to a story that tells us we will be good, that we will be made good, and therefore safe, as long as we follow the rules, as long as we forget that there are rules. We enter the castle gates because there can be no danger here, no cruelty, and no adulthood, for as long as we believe. We will be saved not just from the harm that comes to those who are of no value here, but from the knowledge that they even exist," which I just thought was very poignant. She's so smart. But moving on to our next criticism of Disney adults, and that's that they participate in and perpetuate a culture of overconsumption, which I don't really think you can argue with. Once you get down the rabbit hole of Disney content creators, you'll be bombarded with more Disney-themed plastic junk than you could ever know existed. And, you know, a lot of Disney influencers are just kind of profiting off of convincing other Disney fans to buy, like, this set of ears and this, like, special backpack and this, you know, Funko Pop figurine.
Not the Funko Pops.
But then you'll also see videos and people getting engaged and married at Disney parks, which leads me to this infamous Reddit post, which I'm going to also get you to read.
Yes. I love a dramatic reading. So it's a Reddit post with 392 likes, and it's titled, "Am I the asshole for not having catering at my wedding?" Oh, I'm so excited. Okay. I think she meant to say me. Me, a 28-year-old woman, and my fiancé, a 30-year-old man, just got married 2 months ago, and we had our perfect dream wedding. Everything was perfect, and I mean everything. My parents and his parents helped us pay for a great chunk of the wedding, so we would be debt-free, and we are so eternally grateful for that. The issue arose about a month and a half ago when my aunt started posting on Facebook about how disappointed she was with the whole ordeal, and a few guests sided with her. Oh my god, that's crazy. I love the idea of, like, snarking about your family member's wedding openly on Facebook.
I know, but that's fire. Okay.
Background. My fiancé and I are huge Disney fans, and we travel to Disney World as much as we can throughout the year. Disney is such an important part, not only to us, but also to our marriage. The issue was with our decision to not offer catering services or bar services at our wedding due to routing the money towards having Minnie and Mickey make appearances at our special day. The cost to have both Minnie and Mickey for a good chunk of time, 30 minutes, was almost exactly what our parents allotted for our catering budget. So we scheduled an appearance during our first dance and our wedding photos for going served food, though there were plenty of facilities at the venue where people could eat. Oh my god. My parents were still very supportive of us, but everyone else is being passive-aggressive about it on Facebook. Am I the asshole? Edit. To those asking if the guests were warned, we clearly outlined in the invitations that there was food available at the venue. For everyone saying that it's too much for 30 minutes, I want to clarify that it was two 30-minute sessions on different days. $2,750 was the cost for one session.
So just to clarify, again, the, like, validity and the legitimacy of this post, like, it's an anonymous Reddit poster. We don't know if this is real, like, if this actually happened, but people speculate that it's not the case. But really? Again, it sparks discourse about the willingness and the extent that people are willing to go to and, like, the amount they're willing to pay in order to fulfill their, like, Disney obsession and to, like, incorporate it into every aspect of their life.
There's so many layers. Like, as we know, I'm a bit of, like, a freak about, like, wedding etiquette, and I just really don't. Yeah. One, I believe in an open bar. I think if you're going to have a wedding that you should not make your guests pay for things. Like, they're already having to pay for their outfits, their accommodations half the time, their travel, and also a gift for you. And so, if you're hosting people at a wedding, it is just basic etiquette to, like, give them drinks and food, like, just to feed them for the night. And so that's...
What are you doing?
Why don't you like this? And so that's, like, on one hand, really rude. And then on the other hand, it's really satisfying for some reason. And so there's that. And then the other level of it is the Disney element, which is prioritized.
Maya has been balancing a pen on top of her glasses while she talks. And, like, was playing it off naturally.
I liked the way it looked.
Yeah, very cool.
And on the other hand, yeah, the Disney element just prioritizing Mickey and Minnie Mouse's presence at your wedding over your guests eating. And being like, I told them that there was food at the venue. Like, I would naturally assume that meant, like, food at the venue, as in you're catering it.
I know.
And also the food at the venue is, like, so expensive and probably trash. Like, I hear Disney food was pretty good.
Oh my god, it looks so bad. I watched, like, videos of people eating the different things at Disney, and I was like, oh god, just, I feel like it would make you really constipated or give you the runs, everything that they eat.
Probably, but that's America, baby.
That's America. So Reddit obviously unanimously decided that, yes, this poster was the asshole for obvious reasons. But I feel like one of the really key takeaways from this is to just ask why. Like, why? I want to get inside the brain of the person who posted this and, like, try and understand their motivations. And I think in order to do that, we need to, like, think about how Disney has sort of managed to, like, make a lot of its profits just around itself as, like, a lifestyle brand. I think branching off into the wedding industry was an ingenious business move. And sort of like a perfect example of how they are intentionally marketing to like childless adults. The wedding industry is obviously known for making people think that they need to spend more money than they do on things to kind of make their special day as special as possible. And the Disney parks are kind of similar. Like, you've already spent all this money to come here. You may as well get the most out of your experience by buying all the different packages and getting, you know, special merchandise, getting like the collectible pins and the bags and all of this stuff. And I think once people start posting about this online and sharing it in like vlogs and Instagram posts, it becomes almost competitive the way weddings can be when you see other people's weddings and you're inspired by that. And so, I don't know, it's just like interesting to see once people are in the sort of Disney adult world and mindset and watching all of this content, I guess maybe they're parameters for like what is an acceptable amount of money to spend on something like Disney becomes skewed. But like, I don't know, maybe just like relatively speaking, like if you are in that world, it makes more sense to have Mickey and Minnie be at your wedding than to like feed your grandma.
It's a bit of a, should I use this word so liberally, cult? A little bit cultish, I'll say. A little bit cultish. Like, your expectations are completely skewed and, like, adjusted to what is reasonable. And, like, if the baseline thing at Disney is already super expensive, then, like, of course, like, to have Mickey and Minnie themselves be at your wedding, like, of course you'd spend only $2,700 on that. Like, it just, of course, everything in the park is ridiculously expensive. Of course, like, having this, like, super celebrity appearance is going to be extremely expensive.
Dude, like, watching videos of people going and meeting and taking photos with Mickey and Minnie at the parks, like, all these different, like, vloggers, they talk to them like they're old friends. Like, they're like, oh my god, look at you. Oh, it's so good to see you again. Like, oh my god, I love your new outfit. Like, as if the last person they saw dressed as Mickey and Minnie is the same one in this costume years later. It's really wild.
And it's hard to tell if they're just, like, LARPing, if they're, like, just kind of performing this, or if they really believe it. Like, it kind of becomes hard to tell because then, you know, like, there'll be videos of them. There's this one that I sent Hannah recently of this girl who went viral on TikTok, and she's like, everyone thought that I was special needs because she was, like, in a line to meet Mickey, and when she met him, she was, like, scream crying and, like, jumping up and down and, like, laughing. And they gave her, like, special attention. It's, like, a really infantilized way to behave, and it's just hard to know if they actually believe it or not, especially from these crying videos. It's like, ooh, I don't know if that's a performance. I think that they really are feeling like they're seeing Mickey.
Oh yeah,
like, there's just so much and, spiritual like, value attached to these icons and these characters and these commodities, and it's freaky.
Yeah, well, no, exactly. And I think as much as, yeah, there's obviously like a commercial value, and like, I think, you know, Disney has managed to make itself the subject of an entire like influencer industry, basically, where you have all these people repping one singular brand, which really like ups their brand power. And so obviously Mickey Mouse already being an iconic symbol in America is now also a luxury symbol to this like sect of people. But then also, like what you're saying is, there is a religion of Disney adults. That's sort of the last point I want to talk about. So the last kind of point, which is both a criticism but also something that Disney adults sometimes use in their defense, is that Disney itself is sort of a religion, and being a Disney adult is basically like being a member of that church. I'm sure you've seen the videos of people crying when they arrive at the Magic Kingdom and they see Cinderella's castle. Or there was another one of a woman who went into hysterics because she saw Goofy. And those make the rounds on TikTok. They obviously get a lot of criticism, a lot of backlash. A lot of people cannot understand how somebody could have that kind of reaction to a mascot or a building in a theme park. But I think the context of those videos is that during the pandemic, Disney adults found themselves in the position where they weren't able to visit the theme parks. They weren't able to see these spaces that, like we've established earlier, are basically sacred to them. They were closed for some time, and then also like travel restrictions on top of that made it harder for non-local fans to go and visit the parks, even maybe after they've opened. So when they were able to see the parks again, I think certain sites or characters brought out these emotional reactions to people. In the case of the woman crying at meeting Goofy, she says that Goofy was her late grandfather's favorite character, and she has memories of going with him to the park. And I think what these videos, as kind of insane as they may come across, I think that they illustrate that Disney has like a much deeper and like much more symbolic, almost spiritual importance to the people that are the most devout, I suppose, to the company.
America obviously has like a lot of religions in it and like is kind of known for its more Puritan sects of Christianity and evangelical sects and whatever. But I feel like for a country that is meant to be secular, allegedly, and is so extremely the nexus of global capitalism, at least for the last majority of a century, I feel like yes. Disney kind of is the religion of America. Like it best represents what America is, which is kind of like, you know, putting on this smile, being like nostalgic for like a past that never really was, and spending lots of money. And like that's kind of America at its heart and like the core value of it. So it feels like, of course, so many Americans would feel so tied to this entity, I guess.
Yeah, it's like a mega church. Watching these videos of people crying going to Disney World reminded me of, remember in Mexico City when we went into that church and I was just like overcome with emotion. It was the first time I'd been in a Catholic church since I found out my granny had passed away. And so my first instinct in that moment, I was in New York, was to go to a church. And so after 5 years later, Maya and I went on vacation to Mexico City and we were visiting a church from a touristic perspective. I'm not a practicing Catholic, but I was just brought to tears. And that happened to me again. I was just in Vienna and I went and sat in a church by myself just to kind of see the beautiful artwork. And then I started crying. And I think in that sense, like I could weirdly empathize with what the Disney adults were experiencing when they cried at Cinderella's castle by thinking about the way that Disney is a religion to them. Like once I like thought about it through that lens. And there's this one scholar in particular named Jodi Eichler Levine, who is a self-proclaimed like Disney adult, but also specializes in the intersection between Disney and religion. And she wrote this piece for NBC where she points out how many have described their journey to Disney as pilgrimages. And she defends Disney's religious status against claims that a corporation can't be a religion by saying, yes, Disney's immense cultural power is an example of capitalism on steroids, and the company's track record has some problems, but it is also a storytelling company, which is why people invest so much in its worlds. One of the reasons religions are powerful is because people tell these stories over and over across generations. Even people who don't believe in the literal truth of the Bible often find great emotional resonance in stories of Exodus and liberation, for instance. Just because Disney fan practices are deeply capitalistic does not mean that they aren't also deeply meaningful and at times spiritual. What do you think of this?
I agree that Disney is like a storytelling company. For how much longer, I don't know. Like, I don't know how much longer they can run off the inertia of their past work, because they haven't made a good fucking movie in like 2 decades at this point. Like, they're just generating garbage and like kind of destroying the world of children's animation. But I agree that there is something extremely potent and powerful about the way that they've been able to modernize a lot of like classic folktales. I think that there's been a lot of critique about the way that Disney has reconstructed those folktales and those stories. Like, if you're reading the Old Testament, for example, like, these aren't wrapped up with like a neat happy ending. Like, the Old Testament is bloody and gory and like teaches you a lot of lessons, same as the New Testament, like teaches you a lot of lessons, but also nothing's wrapped up in a neat bow. Like, and I think a lot of the folktales that Disney movies are based off of aren't as well, and Disney kind of put this like extreme gloss over all of it. So like, I guess if we're thinking about them being a storytelling machine, like, yes, but it really is kind of like one type of story that they've been selling for over a century, and that's a story that always results in a happy ending. And I think that that's part of why it's a little disturbing when so many adults wrap their whole identities around Disney, because it's a very censored, or like a very, I don't know how to, like a very sentimental way to view the world that I don't think is necessarily helpful for navigating our world. Like, I don't necessarily think these stories are helpful for navigating, maybe for children, but even then they've come under scrutiny for that. So I don't know about the storytelling angle either.
Well, then, and also, like, I think that is the reason why these people are so attached to Disney, is that they don't want to navigate the real world. They don't want to live in the real world. They don't want to exist in the real world. Mm-hmm. And I think in a lot of ways, when I think of Disney as a religion, I don't necessarily think of it as being connected to the stories or the messaging from their films. I think about it more in the way that, like, people kind of are wrapping their lives around this company and making all of these choices in order to appeal to it, or to like stay connected to it, and spending all of this money and really showing their devotion with their dollars. That to me feels more like the religious aspect of it. And in that sense, I feel like Disney adults, if we're maybe extending this like idea that they could be sort of slightly brainwashed into this weird cult or mega church, then I do feel bad for them in a way. Not too bad. I think obviously like they're adults and they can practice like rational thinking skills.
And I don't think they're vulnerable in the way that a lot of people, like, I don't think all of them are vulnerable in the way that like a lot of people in cults are, who get recruited for cults. So
I mean, like, you have to have some money to be a Disney adult. But I just think that it highlights sort of where the values of a lot of Americans are. And on that note, I wanted to end on a quote again from the Sarah Marshall article that I really liked, where she says, "Maybe as Americans, we would really rather be customers than citizens. Maybe this is all we know how to be." And I don't know. That's what, when I think about Disney as a religion, it makes me think of that.
I completely agree with that statement. I think it speaks a lot to like this kind of, God, this is going to irritate people, but like this kind of late capitalist alienation, right? Like, yes, we have religion, but religion has its like lowest attendance and like membership than it ever has. Like, we are increasingly secular, and well, for a lot of us, all we know really is capitalism. All we know how to do is buy. And so it makes so much sense that Disney would take the place of religion, essentially. And I think that that's a little sad. Like, I think that it's a little bit scary. I don't think that we should necessarily like disdain the people who do this, but I do think that we should be wary of encouraging it either.
No, I think we should all think twice before we replace baby Jesus with Mickey Mouse in our nativity scenes this Christmas.
How much do you think it costs to get him to make an appearance in the nativity?
The fourth wise man would have been Mickey, but Joseph and Mary couldn't shell out the appearance fees.